Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams. Dr. Williams is the author of the acclaimed book, Shattered by the Darkness, Putting the Pieces Back Together After Child Abuse. Dr. Williams is on the senior leadership team at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. And Dr. Williams travels the United States speaking and training professionals, parents, and victims about the importance of dealing with abuse and personal trauma head on and not being afraid to break the silence of your own personal pain. Feel free to call in to tonight's show at 888-627-6008 and speak with Dr. Williams and his guests live on air. And now, your host, Dr. Williams.
All right, good evening and welcome to Breaking the Silence. Here we are live in Houston, Texas, and look at this beautiful sunset right here. It just now started turning the shade of pink, and the sun is right there, just getting ready to go down. We just experienced one heck of a storm here, lightning and all kinds of rain, but it's all cleared up and just absolutely beautiful here. At least in my opinion, the most beautiful place in the world is right here in Houston, Texas. I tell you what, something must be happening with our guest tonight, because I am already getting comments. I'm getting all kinds of things that, hey, we're watching. The numbers are going really good. So this is she must have a following. This is going to be a good program tonight. If you want to get involved, and this is one of those, if you're really going to probably want to grab a piece of paper and an ink pen or pencil to write down some information, because you're going to learn about something about brain development and how trauma affects the brain and all kinds of different, not scientific, but things that impacts our lives from way back to even maybe this past year or two, and how we overcome those. And this is going to be an interesting show tonight, but we would love to get you involved. If you have a comment or you say, hey, wait, I just didn't understand that, can you explain that to me? We would love to have you call into the BBS radio station at 888-627-6008. And the awesome guys there at the BBS will be picking up the phone, and they will patch you right through, and you can talk live with me and the guests tonight, and you'll be right here on the radio around the world. So it'll be great to have you come on, 888-627-6008. Next week, 8 o'clock Central Time, live from Houston, Texas, we're going to be having our guest is Richard Windman, and you will not want to miss that. Matter of fact, the rest of August, we have some wonderful, wonderful guests. And even the first couple of weeks in September, we're booking some wonderful people. Tonight is going to be a no exception. And I want to promise you money back guarantee tonight on this guest this evening. A new friend of mine, got to meet through several different channels. And when I heard her wisdom and the way she presents herself and the information that she provides, I said, hey, wow, can you be on the show and talk about some of this stuff with the people that listen in our audience? And she said, absolutely. We have tonight Lisa Savage, and she is a licensed social worker and a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania. She's founded, and listen to this, the Center for Child Development. We're going to tell you all about what that means. And she founded that about 14, 15 years ago. And her primary mission now is to increase access to mental health services for children and their families. And I think are one of our first people ever from the wonderful state of Delaware. And the Center for Child Development is one of the largest Black-owned private practices in the country, and they have over 50 employees and probably a little bit more than that now. She's co-authored articles about the impact of trauma and toxic stress, those two subjects are the things that I literally speak around the country on. So I'm going to steal all of her ideas and add them to my presentations. And the stress on how it affects developing your mind. She advocates equity in mental health services to marginalized communities, and she works to educate them on how to mitigate the harmful effects of psychological trauma. In addition to that, in her spare time, she's a coach, a speaker, and a consultant, and she also is a co-founder of Clinicians of Color, basically, really probably one-of-a-kind platform to educate and elevate Black and brown clinicians, literally, not just in the United States, but around the world. These websites are going to be something that you're going to want to write those website addresses down. So all the way from Delaware, which I don't even know where that is. I'm very bad with geography. I know it's somewhere close up to Canada. And so close to water by New York, that area. But anyway, from Delaware, we have Lisa Savage. Lisa, can you hear me tonight?
I can. Thank you very much for having me on your show. So Delaware is in the Mid-Atlantic. It's a very, very tiny state. And that's probably why you've never had anybody on from Delaware, because we're so tiny. But we're well known because we have a president from Delaware. So now everybody knows Delaware. We're on the map.
I won't hold that against you. That was just a joke. We don't go political here. That was just a joke, just trying to have fun. I know exactly where Delaware is, and I have been there. So I'm just playing, trying to have a little bit of fun. So it's great having you here. But I do believe you're the only guest we've ever had from Delaware. So, Lisa, I'm looking at and looking already at the phones. With you must have a pretty good community of friends that you work with, that support you, a circle of influence, I like to call it, that you really believe in and you kind of partner up with, right, for this Center of Child Development?
I am very, very fortunate. You're right. I do have a wonderful circle of support, personally and professionally. At the Center for Child Development, like you mentioned, we are a very large private practice where we focus solely on the needs, the mental health needs of children. So when I first started this private practice many years ago, what I realized was that the children that I wanted to see would not be able to get to my office for services. Delaware, it's developed a lot over the past several years, but it's not as developed as like a Houston where public transportation is easily accessible. So I started thinking, how can I help the children that I think most need my services? So I approached some schools in Delaware and said, hey, I'd love to come into your schools and provide mental health services. And one school in particular got it and said, yeah, come on in. And before I knew it, it was taking off because educators, teachers, community members got the importance of having mental health services that were easily accessible to children and their families. And so from there, I created, we've expanded to being community-based. So we're in community centers, we provide services in churches. So pretty much wherever our clients are, that's where we go to provide services. So throughout Delaware, and again, Delaware is very small, so it's not that hard, but from the northern part of Delaware down to the beach, we have therapists who are what we call embedded in schools, providing mental health services.
You know, is it your opinion, because you're right there in the trenches with the school systems, do you think mental health is another load of weight that we've asked the teachers to take on, that what you're providing for the folks in Delaware, we need to be providing to every school in the country, right? Because I mean, they have enough. They're trying to teach. And then to throw all the what's going on in the mental health world has to be a heavier load than normal. What's your view on that?
I absolutely agree. Over the years, I have seen the increase of mental health needs in children. The other thing that I've seen too, Greg, is I've seen teachers understand better and embrace better an understanding of what mental health issues look like. So years ago, before there was a lot of talk about mental health, kids were being medicated, kids were being disciplined at higher rates, kids were being put into alternative schools. And so there's been a push lately to educate teachers, school administrators, and the local communities about why children are acting out. Why are so many children having behavior problems? I'll never forget one day I walked into an elementary school. This was years ago, and it was a two-story elementary school, and a kid literally lifted a chair up and threw it over the balcony down to the first floor. So it would be easy to say, wow, that child is really a bad kid. That kid needs to either be medicated or put into an alternative school. But when you dig down and you begin to understand the influences on that child's behavior and emotionality, what we've come to understand is that a lot of it is toxic stress and trauma that has impacted these children to the point where they don't have the ability to regulate their emotions in the way that other people do. And they don't have the ability to have self-control. So they're very impulsive. Toxic stress and trauma causes a whole myriad of problems. One of the things that I noticed too, I was kind of curious about this, was why are so many children being qualified for special ed? Why are we seeing an increase? And that was because of the behavior and emotional problems. It wasn't because these kids were having learning problems necessarily, but it was the behavioral and the emotional difficulties. And so in my mind, I'm thinking, we've got to do something about this because these children are being categorized and placed into special ed, maybe not learning, because those are difficult and challenging classrooms at times. What do we do to really get to the root of the issue? And that's why I knew that, at least in my practice, we needed to expand our offering of mental health services.
Piggybacking off your illustration of the student throwing the chair over the ledge, instead of grabbing and yanking him the days that I was in school, which was generations ago, and put him in detention or paddling them back in those days. And could it be a scream for help inside that child? I don't Absolutely. Just only want attention. I need somebody to listen to me. I'm hurting.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so as adults, our reflective action is to yell, to scream, for us to become dysregulated along with the child. But in reality, what that kid needs is the adult to stay regulated, to attune to them, to help that child to feel safe, and then begin the work of digging into what's really going on in that child's life. And so that's what we do. And that's, we educate teachers, we educate administrators. Let's not react when that's going, because then we become, like I said, dysregulated as adults. And what that does is that just shoots the kids' emotional regulation off the charts. So if the adult can stay calm, they can better attend to the child.
I want to dig deeper there, because I think the wealth of information that you said in those last couple sentences are things that we hear, but we don't let it soak into the gray matter that parents need to hear. So you're saying that if we stay here, when no matter what's going on with the child, we do a lot better for them than if we go, whoa, I'm going to react. And does, right. if I do this, does it put fuel on the fire? I mean,
it absolutely
old,
does.
Old school, as parents, we carry one of two buckets, either a bucket of water or a bucket of fuel or gasoline. And when they react in such a way, we can either help put it out or we'll help fuel the fire, and it'll take their stress even to a greater level, and nobody's getting any help.
Exactly, exactly. And so what we've learned to do, and what we learned is important, is as the adult, is to manage our own nervous systems. So adults who are in schools, adults who are therapists, adults who are parenting, may have their own traumatic history. And so when something like that happens that kind of catches us off guard, we're going to either go into the fight, flight, or freeze mode, which is a stress response. And so depending on which way we go, we can make that situation with the child better, or we can make that situation with the child worse. So being aware of our own nervous systems and saying, okay, what's going on with me right now in this moment, and how can I better respond to that child so that I don't add more fuel to the fire? And it takes a lot of practice because we're all human at the end of the day, and we all bring our stuff to schools, to our parenting, to our therapeutic relationships. But what's going on with me right now in this moment that either is going to help this child to become more regulated or increase this child's dysregulation? As the adult, I've got to stay regulated. I've got to take a deep breath because that does help to reset the nervous system. And I've got to attune with that child so that child feels safe. And that's the key, helping that child to feel safe, because in that moment, that child is out of control and not feeling safe and wanting an adult to come in and help that child feel safe.
How often do you feel, because you're talking to parents and kids all the time, do you feel that parents rush in to be the person that fixes everything for their kids instead of teaching the child to how to fix it themselves?
Is that
a big issue with parents today?
Yeah, it is actually, because, you know, at the end of the day, we all want our kids to behave and listen, do their schoolwork and be successful. However, all children aren't born with the same type of disposition. So some children become more easily dysregulated than others. And so the key is, it's not necessarily teaching a child how to control him or herself, but teaching a child how to regulate their emotions. And that's an ongoing process. But if parents rush in too quickly and solve the problem or put the fire out for the kid's not learning lessons or the skills that they need to be able to do it in another situation that may be causing them some stress.
You know, it seems like in my day, I would get a pretty good whipping. And if I did the same thing again, I would get whipped even harder. Yep. And it was the process of the parents in those days, well, I'll just beat this out of you. And after the point of where they can't hit any harder and you're still doing the action, where do you turn to? So I really think that teaching, training, not reacting emotionally and just being calm, staying at that level is huge for parents right now.
Yeah, it absolutely is. I mean, spanking really only dysregulates a child even more. The child tenses up, the stress reaction kicks in. That child may fight you back, either physically or verbally, or you may teach that kid to be afraid of you. And so spanking, as we've learned over the years, really doesn't help to solve anything. For a lot of kids, it only causes them to have increased emotional dysregulation because it doesn't teach skills.
And before we take our first break, and we only have like a minute before the first break, is there a difference in that mentality in different cultures? Have you seen?
Oh, absolutely.
Explain just
absolutely.
A little bit.
And really briefly, I feel like in the Black culture in particular, we've resorted to spanking. And I'm not sure of the origins of that. A lot of people will say it kind of goes back to slavery where we were beaten. But there's also the fear in the Black community that if I don't spank you, you're going to get in trouble out there and the cops will have to discipline you. And so the Black community has taken that approach, the corporal approach, as a preventive means to protect their children from being in the streets and having the police officers do it. You'll hear that a lot. I think it's changing. It's definitely changing, but it is a slow process.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, we're going to take our first break. This has been fascinating. I knew you'd be awesome at this tonight. I really did. I was looking forward to this. On the other side of this break, I want to talk about trauma and the brain and how it develops. And I think one of the things, and I know you have this information, but I'm really hoping you do. Give you kind of warning. If not, you can look it up while we're on a break. When does the brain stop developing in a child? And I think that will absolutely lay people out. They always say, oh, at 6 years old, oh, please. We were talking about that right on the other side of the break. It looks like we've got a lot of people coming on, a lot of texts coming through. 888-627-6008. And we will be right back from live from Houston and live from Delaware with Lisa Savage. Don't leave us after this commercial break. We'll be right back. Finally coming very soon will be the release of my second book in the three-part trilogy, Overcoming the Darkness, The Roadmap to Hope. Now, this book will be an in-depth look at the many different facets and emotions that a person goes through when they're experiencing anxiety and trauma in their life, and they're simply searching for hope. And an exciting addition to this book will be a companion journal guide that will come along with it. Also, there's going to be something that I'm very excited about, the youth version of this book called When Dark Clouds Come, The Roadmap to Hope. And it's going to be an excellent tool and guide for teenagers dealing with stress in their lives. So stay tuned for the release date coming very, very soon for these exciting new resources. Now back to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams on the BBS Radio Network. Welcome back. I am so excited to have Lisa Savage with us from Delaware, and she is just talking to us about the development of the brain in a child and how trauma affects that. And I tell you what, this is going to get fascinating now. We're going to turn the corner. There was great information in the first segment, but let's just dig in deep. I got the drill out, and I want to just start drilling down. When it comes to trauma, first of all, and I love getting this, so maybe I can steal some information from you. To you, as a professional in this world, when you deal with this, toxic stress and trauma, what is that? What's that mean? Put that in words that's not so high that it goes over my head and everybody can listen and understand. Can you lay that down to me like I'm a third grader?
Okay. That's a really, really good question, because these are terms that we kind of throw out there. And when I'm talking to parents, I like to break down exactly what trauma and toxic stress is. So toxic stress, let's talk about that. We all deal with stress. So stress is a normal part of living, being, and existing. So kid who goes to school for the first time, they experience some stress because it's a new environment, that kid doesn't know anybody. And that's kind of normal stress. That child will get through that, and eventually it will become, second nature to go to school, and that kid will love going to school. Then there is the chronic type of stress. And the chronic type of stress can exist when we are living in poverty, when we're living in neighborhoods where there's violence, where there are food deserts and we don't have access to good quality foods, or maybe where there's domestic violence going on in the home, or a parent has a mental illness. Those are chronic stressors, meaning they go on and on and on, and the brain doesn't get a chance to get a break from that stress. Toxic stress is when our brain physiology doesn't have a chance to settle down. So there are all kinds of neural hormonal changes that happen when we're under stress. And so, like I said, with the kid who goes off to school for the first time, yep, that child may experience neural hormonal changes. And then eventually they go back to normal. But with chronic or toxic stress, those hormones, those neurochemicals stay floating in our bodies and they begin to affect us. It's the reason why we are seeing so many people in communities, and not just poor communities, but communities with chronic health conditions, high blood pressure, diabetes, alcoholism. It's also a reason why there are a lot more learning disabilities as well in kids who grow up with chronic or toxic stress. That stress, because it stays at such a high level for such a long time, it impacts us on so many levels. And so my concern is when I'm working in a school and it's an elementary school, and I know that that kid's living in an environment where there's a potential for toxic stress, while I may not be able to physically extricate that kid and her family out of that environment, educating that parent about how to mitigate the impact of the toxic stress is really what's important. And the first key to helping the parent, to help the kid, is helping the parent. Because oftentimes the parent has endured toxic stress him or herself. And they also don't understand why they may have depression, anxiety, addictions, eating problems, you name it. And so educating that parent to take better care of him or herself, attend to their mental health, then in turn helps the child. And so I'm a strong proponent of educating parents and communities about what all this looks like. Because if we can't educate parents, then we can't really help children. And so that's part of what we do. And then we teach children how to calm their nervous systems through deep breathing and through other means, therapeutic means that we use to help children to calm their nervous systems.
So are you saying that the reason a neighborhood just on the other side of town, that's a marginalized community, that's economically depressed compared to another neighborhood that's an upper affluent community, those children, those parents, live at a different level of constant toxic trauma that is pushing through things in their brain and their body, and your body just does not design to stay.
Yes.
It's kind of like a car engine being revved up all the time.
Correct.
And it's just causing internal and mental and emotional.
Is that
what you're saying?
That's exactly what I'm saying. So when I'm driving through neighborhoods where there's a high rate of poverty, there's food insecurity, there's a high rate of violence, as I'm looking around the communities and I'm seeing people, I mean, I'm just thinking about this community just north of where I live. And on the corner, every morning when I drive through that neighborhood, I see countless people with canes, young people walking with canes. And I'm going, why? And so when I start to think about what these people are dealing with in their lives, it begins to explain to me why they may be having some of the physical problems that they're having. So arthritis, fibromyalgia, autoimmune diseases, it explains it to me. When I'm in a school where there are marginalized communities and I see children who are overweight, the first thing I think about is not necessarily that these kids aren't eating healthy, and that's part of it, but I also think about things like their bodies holding on to those neurochemicals that make it difficult for them to lose weight, that make it difficult for their bodies to process foods in a way that other people would who haven't lived under that kind of stress. I also know that in Black and Brown communities, that because there's a high rate of obesity, high blood pressure, diabetes, you name it, that if doctors understood the role and function of food in these communities, the rate of obesity would decrease. Because we could then educate people rather than shaming them about their weight and about how they, we could educate them to help them to understand some simple things that they can do to decrease their stress. Walking, for example, getting involved in sports. Those are all things that help to kind of regulate the nervous system and get the brain from being so overly active and kind of spewing all these negative chemicals. Another example, really quickly, I remember years ago, I was dealing with a lot of stress. I just started my private practice and was dealing with all the stress. I went to see a doctor because I couldn't lose weight. That's what it was. And I went to see my doctor and she ran blood tests. And she did a test of my cortisol level. It was off the hook. Cortisol is the bad chemical that if it stays active in our bodies, it creates weight gain. It creates difficulty sleeping. And so even me personally, who had been through a period of intense stress, saw the negative effects in black and white in a lab result on my own body. And so again, that helped me to understand the connections between what's going on with us mentally and emotionally, and then what happens with us physically. And so that's what drives my passion to be able to help children, because the longer that goes on, the more detrimental it is to us physically, emotionally, and you name it.
Yeah. You know, I've been following or starting to get really, really studying Gabor Mate with the trauma. Yeah. And I was watching a masterclass the other night and that I was taking, and he was talking about the African-American communities, and he was saying, you know, the statistics of hypertension in the Black community is so much. And he kept saying, think about it, hypertension. And he said it over about five times where everybody was listening and laughing in the audience. It's like, yeah, you're making your point. He says, because their community has, you know, hypertension is always at this hyper level. And that's why. And he threw out all the statistics, and it was several years old, the speech, but he's like, hey, he made a point. And it's like, wonder.
Yeah.
And sometimes, sometimes we just overlook that because communities, just walking out of your house across the street to get the mail, in some communities, brings no stress. It's a beautiful day. In some communities, you got to look around everywhere, and it automatically kicks you to a different level in living life.
Absolutely. Yeah, you have to be hypervigilant all the time. And maintaining that level of hypervigilance has a negative impact on us. And so again, you know, I'll share a story working in an elementary school one day after school. The kids all go to a community center, and it's a great place for them to go. Well, one day, somebody gets shot outside the community center. The kids all duck, and you know, the next day they're coming, they're telling me the story about it, and they seemingly go on with their lives. They go on to school, we process it, we talk about it, but that's not normal. That is not normal. No child should have to experience that level of violence and then just be expected to go back to school and perform. So again, having easily accessible mental health services can help those children to understand and to process that trauma, because that was a trauma for them, so that it doesn't have the deleterious impact on them. I did not want them to think that that was okay, that this person got shot outside of their community center. That was not okay. It was not okay that they had to witness that. And so I spent time with them processing, talking, what did you see? What is your understanding? To help them to, one, feel safe. The school's a safe environment. I'm a safe person. But to help them to understand that that's not a normal circumstance and that they shouldn't have to see that. I can't change it, obviously, but I can change the negative processing that often happens when a child doesn't have access to somebody who's safe and caring and who wants to listen to them and validate their experiences.
From your opinion, do you think the last few years has been an eye-opener for the people in America of what kind of trauma and stress some communities are dealing with on a daily basis? Do you think we're getting better of recognizing it than we have in the past? Somehow I lost you.
I think we're good.
Okay, now I can. Yeah. Do you think it's becoming better now?
The Wi-Fi?
No, we're having a bad connection on your end, apparently. I want to make sure you have an unstable connection. Tell you what we're going to do. Lisa, we're going to take the last break, and then we'll come back and have an elongated section on this side. So let's go ahead and take a break. We'll make sure your connection's really good, and we're back up and running right on the other side of this break. 888-627-6008, and we'll be right back.
HCI Publishing, that brought you the international bestsellers, A Child Called It, and the Chicken Soup for the Soul series, comes the latest book by Dr. Gregory Williams, Shattered by the Darkness. This book describes the horrific abuse that Dr. Williams suffered at the hands of his father for over 12 years, and the damaging effect of keeping everything silent about that abuse for 30 years. If you're looking for that book that you can't put down, then pick up a copy of Shattered by the Darkness by Dr. Gregory Williams at all Barnes & Noble stores, Amazon, and Books A Million. Now, back to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams.
Welcome back, and welcome to live radio. So I've lost her picture right now, but why she is coming back off the street, she must have a bad connection or something going on there. Shattered by the Darkness, want to make sure that you, if you haven't got a copy of this yet, to jump on our webpage or Amazon. Amazon's the best place to get it. You can get it cheaper at Amazon than what I can get it myself. But anyway, jump in and get that, and Overcoming the Darkness. Is getting ready to come out with When the Dark Clouds Come, which is the one I'm excited about, what teenagers can learn of how to get through the days when there are dark clouds and storms brewing. Lisa, welcome back. I'm glad you're here.
Thank you.
Go ahead and take a drink, and you're fine.
Okay.
When we went with the bad connection for a second, I was asking if you thought the last few years, and I did not catch your reply, has been an advancement of our eye opening to what's going on in all of our communities, especially the marginalized.
Yeah, I do. I think so. I think because there's been so much research.
Hope.
Absolutely.
Good,
absolutely.
Good.
Tons
yes.
of hope. Tons good. Of hope. Yeah. Are you able to hear me okay?
Yes, you're fine. You're perfect.
Okay, great. But yeah, I think there's tons of hope because of the research that's been done. And I also think because people are becoming more educated about what all this means to them and their communities.
Okay. Now let's, because I promised the last segment we didn't get to because we chased a rabbit, which was really a good rabbit. Tell me about the trauma and how it does affect the developing brain of a child and how it affects it. And maybe just give us a simple course on when the brain is most impactful developing, and then when it actually is fully developed, when does that happen in a child?
Yeah. So the brain in the beginning is a very fragile, organ, because it is an organ. And so depending on what happens in utero, when the mom is carrying the child, and then certainly through birth of the child, and then the developing years of a kid, we just have to be mindful of what impacts that kid. Again, there's circumstances that parents can't help, but it's the attachment to the parent that makes all the difference in the world. So if a parent, for example, is dealing with stress, personal stress themselves, that child is going to pick up on it because that child is innately connected to that parent until they begin to develop their own sense of self. So if a parent is reassuring and loving and connected, stays connected emotionally to that child, that's going to be wonderful. So when that relationship becomes fractured, meaning the parent is dealing with their own emotional problems and unable to be attached, connected emotionally to that child, that's when we began to start to see the effects of that attachment going awry. So the child may experience some depression or anxiety. If a parent has untreated mental health, and that child is intuitively picking up on that as well, again, not blaming the parent, but educating parents about why it's important to attend to our own stuff, it's going to impact that child. The brain develops, but it doesn't completely develop until the child is an adult at the age of 25. So 25 years old, and even at 25, our brains are still developing. So the prefrontal cortex, where all the rational thinking and the impulse control is, that really doesn't kick in until 25 years old or later. And so while we may be expecting our kids to have, you know, perfect control and not be impulsive, that may be a little bit unrealistic until that child is a full-grown adult.
Well, yeah, it's unrealistic for me at 57 or 58 years old. It's like, hey, wait, you know, it's still developing.
Exactly. I'm with you on that, Greg.
Yeah, I tell you, it just sometimes, you know, you said something that is fascinating to me. Of course, I work in an OB-GYN department at Baylor College of Medicine, and we're starting to look at, and I'm really hoping to get grants on this, of the trauma that the mother had as a child, mm-hmm. how it affects mm-hmm. the child that mm-hmm. she is carrying in her womb. Yeah. And to my understanding now, there's great research coming out that the DNA could be affected in inside that child's brain before it ever yep. sees the world. Yep. Do you have any wisdom on that?
So actually I do. I mean, it's the whole epigenetics. It's also, yes. I think, an explanation for why Black and Brown communities deal again with so much trauma and the negative effects of toxic stress because of epigenetics. So the DNA from our ancestors years and years ago may still be showing up in us and in our children, but also behaviors. Survival techniques, whether or not they're good or bad or unhealthy, we're passing them down based on trauma. And so some of the maladaptive ways that we've learned how to cope because of racism, because of other societal ills, we may be inadvertently passing them on to our kids, thinking that it's the right thing, kind of like Black parents spanking their kids. But what we know now is that it's not necessarily the right way to interact, teach our children how to behave. And so there's a lot of science on epigenetics, which is amazing to me, that does show that through the DNA, we can pass on trauma. So trying to break those intergenerational, what we call curses, I think is so important. And I think self-awareness, and of course, I go back to educating communities about how that can happen and how it often does happen.
Is wisdom education the key? I mean, is it time that we all went back to school literally? I mean, I'm not talking about really going into classrooms, but that we need to teach the people of our country and around the world also that, yeah. hey, wait, we have to break these cycles. If not, it's going to end up continuing on. And yep. this is the new way that we need to parent. This is a new way we need to deal with children. This is a yep. new way we need to deal with it in schools. Education. We have to teach teachers and parents.
100%. It starts with education. It starts with treatment as well, mental health treatment. And so there's a big push now for people to go to therapy and not feel the stigma of seeking help. Because what we know is there's a lot of treatment that has been proven to be able to stop the impact of trauma. And so if a parent gets treated and they deal with their trauma and they understand their trauma, they're going to be better parents because most parents want to be good parents, but maybe they don't know how, or maybe their own past history is impacting how they're seeing their kids, seeing themselves, seeing their kid, how they interact with them and how they treat them. But if they could get treatment, have a better understanding of how that gets transmitted until somebody decides that it's going to stop, then I think we could raise a different generation of children. I do.
Do you see that and I mentioned this on a lot of the shows lately since the pandemic, that there could be some positive that comes out of this, that after this is over with, we realize that maybe everybody in the world has some type of mental health issue and we all need help, and there's nothing wrong with seeking help?
Correct. I think being under this pandemic has brought it to surface in a lot of ways. I was sharing this story with somebody the other day. Last March, when it first hit and we all kind of closed things down, every night I was waking up with rapid heartbeat. Every night I was waking up, looking at the ceiling, worried about myself, worried about my husband, my mother, my siblings, you know, and hoping to God that we would all stay healthy. And thank God we did. But does that anxiety just go away? It does not. It does not. So what I've had to do in the past 18 months is really center my mental well-being. Mm. So that meant things like working out on a regular basis, which I do, doing deep breathing, breath work helps a lot. Learning new skills. I did that as well. Taking a break from things. As you mentioned at the beginning of the interview, I'm very busy. I do a lot of things, but learning to manage my schedule so that it feels good and manageable to me are all things that I've had to learn how to do, so that that anxiety didn't become a pattern, a disorder. So I do think that the pandemic has raised a lot to the surface that we kind of can't ignore right now. And so for anybody who's out there listening, I share my story because I'm a mental health professional. I struggle with anxiety, and I know that there are things that we can do that are pretty simple to help lessen it.
Give us a tip. And I know I'm just throwing it because we don't have preset questions, which drive my guests crazy most of the time. But a tip that you can give a parent right now for a child that is starting to get anxious, starting to stress out, starting to go to the extreme of the drama role, and you can see that the tension's building. What tip do you give parents of, hey, wait, try this with your child next time? What would that be?
Yeah, I mean, a great question, because schools are getting ready to open. My biggest concern is, what is this all going to mean for our children and their mental health? I'm seeing lots of anxiety. The one thing I'm seeing is more anxiety in boys. We typically have seen anxiety be an issue that we most identify with girls, but I'm seeing a lot of boys have anxiety. My tip to parents right now is to start talking to your child. What do you feel right now? What do you feel in your belly? What do you feel in your head? What do you feel in your heart? Try to help that kid to become more in tune to what's going on in their body, because that's really where anxiety starts to show up. And then you can do something simple, like do deep breathing with your kid. Do it together so that that child sees you practicing it and you're modeling that healthy behavior for yourself. Deep breathing, we always tell people to do this, but we don't tell them why. It resets the nervous system. So when our nervous system starts to come offline and we start to experience those symptoms within our body, a deep breath helps to reset it. And so if you can practice that with your kid every single day, it becomes a habit. And then your child, you'll notice a change in how they're interacting with you, a change in how they're interacting with themselves, and a change in how they're interacting with their friends. It's a simple but effective coping skill that we can teach kids immediately. It doesn't cost us any money and little time.
So you're a big advocate of mindfulness, obviously, and the breathing.
How
about journaling? Do you recommend that in your
school? Yeah, absolutely. Journaling is awesome. So I recommend two types of journaling. One is where you write in your book. And exactly, you know, what's going on in your life. I tell kids that I work with, just start writing. Don't think about what you're going to write, just start writing. And they might be surprised at what shows up. But there's another type of journaling. I call it shared journaling. So it's between a parent and a child. And this works with adolescents. So the child writes in the journal one day, gives it to the parent reads what the kid wrote, and then the parent writes a response, and then it goes back to the kid. And so I love this because what a kid may not say to you verbally, they're more inclined to write it because they're going into a more relaxed state. Journaling is sort of a mindful exercise. And so it decreases judgment. They know that their parent's going to respond back. And it increases the chance that your child is going to be more honest with you about what's going on with them. And it creates that attachment that helps the kid to feel safe.
Yeah, it's almost impossible to bury aggressiveness or hurt or trauma when you're writing about it. So instead of burying it, you are unburying it. I mean, you are digging it up and you're letting it out. And once you let it out, you don't have to carry it around.
Exactly.
It's released. Exactly. And that has to be a stress breaker.
Yes.
Tell me, because we only got a couple minutes, the Center of Child Development, if somebody, you know, tell me about what that is real quick, and then I want you to give the webpage or how they can get in touch with you before we close out.
Yeah. So it's my practice, the Center for Child Development.com. It's located in Newark, Delaware. We, see children ages, we start at age 2 and we see them all the way up to adulthood. In fact, we see quite a bit of adults as well because kids come attached to adults who often have issues themselves. And so if anybody out there who's in the Delaware area or who just wants to talk to me and connect, get connected to other services, because I know therapists all around the country, they can certainly look me up on the centerforchilddevelopment.com. And I respond to every single email that I get. There's a form on the website to email us, and I'll get back to you. So again, my big platform is education and also connecting people to the mental health services that they need.
I tell you what, Lisa, it was a joy tonight. And I appreciate you spending the evening for an hour with us tonight on the show and just sharing your wisdom. I'd love to have you back on.
Absolutely.
We didn't even get to the tip of the iceberg, and I knew we wouldn't. But thank you so much.
Yeah, my pleasure. And I apologize for the Wi-Fi issues. Hopefully. Oh, good. Okay. Well, no, thank you very much. Thank you.
But thank you for being here, and tell your circle of influence, thank you for their comments. And I'm sure it's them, but I'm not for sure. But we are getting a lot of, I'm getting a lot of texts tonight about great show. Thank you. Wonderful wisdom. Great speaker. And if they want to get in touch with you for a consult or even a coaching situation, or if they want you to come to a school, possibly if they want to just get back with you at the Center for Child Development.com. Okay.
Yep.
Thank you, Lisa, so much.
My pleasure.
Okay.
You have a great evening.
You have a great evening too. Like I like to do every single week, I always end the show in the same way, and you may get tired of this, but I'm not going to apologize because it's so true. No matter what's going on in your life, good, bad, or ugly, no matter what you're dealing with right now, and no matter what you have to face tomorrow, I want to let you know there's always hope. There's always hope. Dig deep for that hope. Never give up for that hope. Fight for that hope because you are worthy of it. Join us right here next week for another edition of Breaking the Silence, live from Houston, Texas at 8 p.m. Central Time. Have an awesome week, will you? God bless you and good night.
Thank you for listening to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams. To contact Dr. Williams, dial 832-396-6525 or email him at shatteredbythedarkness@gmail.com. And don't forget to join us each Sunday night at 8 p.m. Central Time, 6 p.m. Pacific on BBS Radio Station 1, for the next episode of Breaking the Silence.